amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie show. I'm here with Paul and with Steve this week, and we're talking about mostly earnings that have been coming in because it's right in the interesting bit of earnings season. We had some good reports this week from the banks and from Costco and Netflix, but we don't have time for any of those. We're too busy talking about other things that were more interesting to us, things like how our weeks have been. Steve, start with you. How's your week been?
It's been over pretty fast, really. I can't really think of anything significant that I've done. I ate some IKEA meatballs in the middle of the week. That's about as good as it got, I think. I've been on site one of the days. The other days I've just been sat in the office. It's not been a very busy week for us. I haven't got much to report on in terms of stocks. It's been an awful week. By imagine it's been an awful week for absolutely everybody. I think I'm down about 3.5% on the week, which actually, looking at it, isn't as bad as I thought it was. I thought I must be smashing the market in that regard. It's fine, really. Nothing to report. How about you, Paul?
I was gonna say, good job. There's three of us this week, isn't it? How are you, Paul?
I've done nothing but sit on planes all week, so it's been a bit boring to me as well. The market, though, interesting one that I saw from my portfolio, as in I've got, you know, a bit of tech, bit of safety, bit of everything in both directions. The biggest hard hitters, I think, for me were Blackstone, who came in a little bit light on the revenue, but that should be totally expected as far as I can see. I can't understand why that one took such a hit. I'm sure it's still got a huge cash position. I haven't been able to actually look at anything. So ASML also took a massive hit this week, and I've done zero looking into that. So I'm looking forward to Steve D's breakdown on that, because it's going to teach me a lot. But on the opposite side, AT&T came in pretty well. So the 7% balance just evened everything out. So it's largely been a flat week for me, which has been quite good.
Wow, I would take flat. Mine has not been flat. Mine has been well down. By the way, Paul, if we know you're kind of busy at the moment, but if you ever do want to check in on how the ASML stuff is going, especially the ASML share price, all you have to do is watch this show on any given week, and Steve has this handy gadget that can show you what the ASML share price has been doing. I think it's just over his left shoulder, and it's far too small for me to read on this screen that I can see it on. But we do have a handy ASML monitor on this show for anyone that's interested in how they're getting on. My week has been more like Steve's. It's been terrible and empty. Stock market, I think nearly everything I own is down, as far as I can tell. I can't see anything that's not gone at least partly down, some of it worse than others. And I'm seeing a red number that is bigger than the red number I've seen recently. So that's, I suppose, a decent time to be buying stuff. It looks like a reasonable time to be buying stuff. It looks like stuff is on sale to me everywhere. I continue to think that REITs are all underpriced. Happily, we're not talking about any of those this week, but I found another one for some future week that I can try and ramp higher on this show. Steve, you look like you want to say something here.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I also was looking at the REIT podcast that you put forward the other week from Streetwise, and I was reminded yesterday to find out what BXP was, only to find out it was Boston Properties, which mm-hmm. we should have known. I just had no idea that was what they'd either rebranded themselves to or changed the ticker to. So
That's always Boston been Properties. Their ticker from what I remember of it. They're an interesting one if you believe that the commercial real estate pressure will be uneven, which it probably will, and you believe that quality will come out stronger than it went in. And that might be a larger assumption. But Boston Properties, I think, is one of the better ones in this space. If you think there
big
will be still some
well.
Demand. For, yeah, very
I think
big.
They're, like, they're third or fourth biggest in the US, I think. A 40-odd billion market. Well, there was a 40-odd billion market cap. I know everything's gone back a bit on Friday, so I'm not sure exactly where they are.
Yeah, this week coming up is half term, which means that I've got an interesting week coming up of maybe some additional childcare and trying to work out how to get my parents, Alistair's grandparents, to to do things unsupervised by me while I try and get work done. So I'm this week mostly has been trying to get things into shape for next week and get as far as I possibly can ahead on work, which it turns out is not a million miles behind, is as far ahead as I can possibly get. So if I really put a big shove in, I can be about where I'm supposed to be at the start of this week, and then I can concentrate on not panicking. But that's been basically my week outside of the stock market. I've also consumed some interesting stuff. That's mostly a thing I've been doing this week, sat around listening to podcasts and not this one. The thing I've consumed is a podcast I've only just heard of, but I think I'm about the last person on the face of the earth to have heard of it. It's called Modern Wisdom. It's by a guy called Chris Williamson, who was once a contestant on Love Island, but he's far more thoughtful than I believe most contestants on Love Island are. That's me making assumptions about a show I have absolutely never watched. But he, I think the tagline is something like Life Lessons from the Smartest People on the Planet. It also includes quite a few people, from what I can tell, who don't fall into that category. But there is some really interesting stuff in there. If, like me, you're interested in listening to famous investors, partly for their investing insight and partly for the how they run their day and how they think about the world and how they manage their lives and what principles they kind of operate under, not to go all Ray Dalio on this for the moment, but something like that, then you might find this really interesting. From what I've seen so far, I've listened to about 4 episodes. I think this is an instance of, I've really enjoyed them, but I've been very much sat in a kind of fairly comfortable area at the moment. Steve was talking last week about the importance of listening and engaging and thinking with people who disagree with you. I've been listening mostly so far to people who say nice things about how important my part of humanity is. And that's nice to hear too. I'm not saying they're wrong necessarily. The fact they're saying nice things doesn't mean they're false. But when we get on to more challenging bits for me, I guess that'll be interesting. I really like this show. I find it very interesting, very thoughtful. Chris Williamson's very impressive to me. I think at its worst, it turns into basically a large quote fest of people chucking around.
I was just about to say that.
At its best, there are some really, really interesting ideas. Paul, you know this podcast then.
Yeah, you've stolen my discussion there because I'm really 50-50 on this. I think he's all... I think he's... Of course he's smart. And the people he has on are really smart. If you want to take the latest one I listened on the plane was Jimmy Carr. That's why I went back to it, because I thought, Jimmy Carr's going to say some cool stuff. But it was just them two trading philosophical quotes, which a lot of them don't really have that much substance. I don't know what to say about it. There's sometimes they've got really good guests on, and it's the same as Stephen Bartlett as well, the other something...
Maybe
Diary of a CEO, I think it is. Dragonstone
Man.
It's called. Yeah, it's his stuff is quite good. Sometimes depends on who you get on, but a lot of time it's just a therapy session for CEOs, and you're just sitting there going, "Oh, right, we're just going to listen to you." And fair enough, there's stories in there that you can gather a lot out of. I don't know. I see it as them whinging a lot of the time. But, you know, it is really popular, so I must be missing something. I'm very 50-50 on that Chris Williamson one at the minute. Because of that reason, it's just like, it's constantly like he's trying to get Instagram reel quotes into the stratosphere. So if he says an Instagram reel quote, like 60-second or 30-second snippet that he can just put out into Instagram and then chop it up, he's going to get popular. And that seems to be his strategy. And naturally, because there's no algorithm in podcasts, you're using the algorithm from Instagram to gain your followers, and that's where he gets to. And obviously, there's a bit of money involved there as well. But it's, you know, it's there. It is something. I did listen to it all the way through. And Jimmy Carr wasn't as insightful as I thought he'd be, which is a bit of a shame. There you go. That's my lowdown on it.
That's interesting because I've never heard of this podcast nor the person. I thought Chris Williams, and we were talking about the disgraced Labour MP who spent most of his time on Iranian TV. So I was thinking, like, why would anyone give him a podcast, and why would anyone want to go on that?
Why would anyone call it Modern Wisdom?
Yeah, Modern Wisdom. Chris Williams is about 300 years old. I seem to remember him looking like Voldemort.
To bring it back to investing, the most recent episode I was listening to was Cody Sanchez, who's I think now a hedge fund investing person, kind of angel investor, former Goldman Sachs equities analyst, talking about being a contrarian. I thought that episode was mixed. I thought it started quite strongly and faded away a little bit, just my view on it. But I think that's, I think there's important things that kind of cross over a little bit into our stuff that we think about, even if it's not explicitly a finance show in the same way. Steve, you've got something similar you've been listening to, right?
Sort of, yeah. I, again, the Behind the Money podcast from the Financial Times, which I think I've recommended three times now. But this one is quite interesting for anybody who is slightly left-leaning on sort of political issues, because this one was titled Argentina's 16 billion saga with a US court. And it all revolves around basically an Argentinian oil company, which, you know, in order to raise money, one side of the political spectrum listed it in America via an ADR. And then in 2012, when the left-leaning party came over, they nationalized it and without paying shareholders for doing it. So basically, because it was listed in America, a US court has been able to rule on that that transaction, essentially. And we have this really strange scenario where a US court is having jurisdiction over a sovereign nation, and Argentina, a nation that probably can't afford to have any more debt, so can't really afford to pay this bill, and as such I don't think has paid it. So yeah, really, really interesting little sort of, and it's really quick as well. It's all over in about 15-20 minutes, and you get through quite a lot of information, and worth a listen to see where you fall, really, because I think especially during when Corbyn was semi-popular, there was a lot of people just saying, well, if you don't like it, we'll just, you know, we'll nationalize this, and if you don't like that, well, we'll just nationalize that industry, and, you know, broadband should be nationalized. And then you start to look at these things and you think, well, that doesn't always work. And since nationalizing this oil company, it's gone awfully. It's gone awfully to the point where they want to flog it again, which they obviously can't do because there's this court ruling over the top of it. So really interesting podcast, and I think you'll enjoy it for a little short story.
Yeah, I don't want to. I suppose I've listened to so much, I can't really point anything out. I can go back to Howard Marks again because he did that. He reiterated his point on the sea change this week in his podcast, which was very interesting. Essentially, as far as I can tell, saying that this time it's different, and we all know how that goes. But he does rationalize it quite well. So that was interesting. The second I just wanted to point out is I'm pretty sure I just logged into the Twitter for the first time in a long time, and somebody has posted a photograph of Morgan Housel's new book. So that must be nearly out, or at least out. So that one I'm very much looking forward to, and I'm sure you guys probably are too.
Yeah, I was going to say, just hang fire on that one, though, before you do, because I've reached out to Morgan Housel because there's an extra chapter edition, which is through Barnes & Noble in America. And I've just asked him who's getting the deal for the UK, if anybody is. So we might be able to bring you some news on that next week. There might be a special version to get the extra chapter edition from in the UK, I hope.
Ooh, are you thinking it's there to be bid for, Steve, that we might introduce the Playing Footsie publishing arm?
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, we'll have it.
Famously impressive business. Or are you going to try and hook it onto Bloomsbury so we can all make money
off
of
maybe,
it?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I was just thinking, it got me thinking then about Paul's recommendation for the Lex Friedman podcast.
Mm.
I've never listened to Lex Friedman, and it was quite funny to see two robots talking to each other in the metaverse. But actually, Paul's right. If yes. You have any interest in the metaverse, in fact, even if you don't have any interest in the metaverse, I would just give the first sort of 5 or 10 minutes of that a listen. So the first 10 minutes is Lex Friedman trying to show you that he has some kind of emotions. He says he's going to cry, but his face like tells a different truth. But when they're playing with the lighting around each other's faces in that podcast, that looks incredible. And to say that we were taking the mick out of that because it looked like Farmville only like a year ago, the difference now is stark. It's a big difference. Only thing I would sort of point out,
if
which
either
would
of them
ruin
had
the
muscles in their eyebrows, they'd be able to show it. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, they look like the sort of like soccer mums who've got Botox in the foreheads, don't they? They just don't move at all. But
I think
what will break the immersion, because I think you'll spend a lot of it going, "Wow, this is great, this looks amazing." But watch their arms. Their arms don't. They've got no technology to track the arms, so they just stay like glued to the sides. But facially, picking up facial expressions, picking up the little minute movements in the corner of your mouth and the corner of your eyes and the wrinkles in your forehead, it does a very, very good job of that. And it does look really realistic. But Zuckerberg does explain that they had to go through an hour of scanning each in a high-tech machine to get this. But he thinks, and they have a working version where the vast majority of this can be done by essentially just waving a phone in front of your face until it picks up these minute movements. But it might be one of those things that you have to set up and it works forever. Interesting though. I would recommend people just spending 5 or 10 minutes just watching that and seeing how far that technology has come along.
Okay. In that case, that's enough of what we've been consuming this week. No one really cares about what we've been consuming anyway, and we're starting to run out of ideas. Steve, what has everyone else been consuming? Specifically, what have US teens been consuming over the last however long it was since we last talked about this subject?
Well, I've been watching them through my no, 6 months is
thank you.
Been watching them through my telescope. This is the Piper Sandal Teen Server. And they do this every 6 months. And last time we did this, a lot of people said it was quite insightful and that they quite enjoyed it. So I've had a really good scan through the report again, and I found out sort of 24 things that I thought were quite important and something that you can maybe lean towards your sort of stock purchases or your conviction in certain stocks. So 37% of teens hold a part-time job. So when people say that teens don't work, 37% of them was. Unfortunately, that is actually down from in spring when it was 40%. Teens' self-reported spending was down 1% year-on-year to about $2,316. That's also down 4%. Parent contribution was 62%, up from 60%. So parents are definitely lending money for kids to spend still.
They're not lending it, are they? Are they lending money for their kids to spend?
Lending in the... Yeah, not giving.
Teen debt is a long-term yield. It's a 60-year yield, that is.
Yeah. Bank of mum and dad lending.
Sorry, Steve, carry on.
Upper income teens, food is the number one wallet priority for males, spending at 25% share. Clothing remains top of female wallet share at 28%. That's down 260 basis points versus last year, when female clothing wallet share peaked at 30%. The core beauty wallet, Steve, cosmetics, skincare, and fragrance was $324 a year. That's up 23% year on year. That was led by cosmetics, which is up 33% year on year. Keeping on cosmetics, they held the highest priority of beauty spending at $127. That's the highest level we've seen for about 3-4 years now. Weekly usage of VR devices declined to less than 10%. From just less than 14% in spring 23, but actually now a third of teens own a VR device, up from 29% back in spring 23. Video games, about 11% of male teen wallet share, that's actually fallen. It used to be 12%. 33% now expect to purchase a next generation console within the next 2 years. In terms of banking, Square's Cash App was number one. It was the most preferred for peer-to-peer money transfers. About 50% of them, teens surveyed, said that was their preferred. Venmo came in second at 36%. So, a duopoly in that sense. For buy now, pay later, it was different though. PayPal's Pay in 4 was used the most frequently, followed by Square's Afterpay. Apple Pay ranked number one for payment apps within the last month at 42%. Cash App was second at 27%. 55% of teens cited Amazon as their number one favorite e-commerce site. And then there was Shein, I don't know how to pronounce that. Nike, Goat, and
this
Timo
is a new one. Shein's a new one that I've only seen recently. Just to let you know, it's going to IPO soon as well.
This is what's destroying. To look at. Yeah, this is what's destroying Boohoo and ASOS, isn't it? Shein.
It's huge where.
So Nike remains the number one brand.
Living. Sorry. Just doing a Becky, that's all.
Nike remains the number one brand for all teens in both apparel, 35%, and footwear, 61%. New Balance has now surpassed Vans as number four favorite footwear brand. New Balance gained about 200 basis points of mind share year on year. Vans lost about 350 basis points of mind share year on year. Crocs came in at number six. Hey Dude came in at number seven. They were the favorite footwear brand amongst amongst all teens. They gained 30 basis points and 50 basis points.
Hoka came in at number 2075.
On Running and Hoka 1-1 were number 8 and number 13 across all teens, but in the upper income category, they were 5th and 3rd in terms of athletic brands. So, and that's because they're so bloody expensive. In terms of number one cosmetics brand, that was Elf or ELF, increasing 13 points year on year. It's now 29% for female teens. Speciality retail for beauty purchases reached the highest level yet at 79%. This is your Ulta's and things like that. Mass department drugstores, they've reached a new low of 11%. So if you're thinking your kids are going to start going to Walgreens to buy their cosmetics, which is a high percentage of their wallet share, that seems unlikely. So number one was, I think it's Sephora, but it might be Sephora, but that's now surpassed Ulta for the number one preferred beauty destination. Ulta is number two. That had the strongest loyalty membership at 67%. Ulta's was at 60, so still very, very strong. Chick-fil-A remains the number one restaurant in the US. It had a 16% share. It was followed by Starbucks at 13% and McDonald's at 9%. Teens wanting to consume plant-based meat has hit an all-time low. It's had a 35% fall this year, and it was 49% willing to try in spring 21. Teens reporting their highest intentions to eat more or the same amount of Mondelez Cliff Bar, CBP's Goldfish Cracker Bars, I think they're called. They were the most popular snack brand. Monster, 28%, Red Bull, 23%, and Celsius, 16%, are now teens' favourite energy drink brands. Celsius is coming in at 16%. It's quite interesting because their market share is only about 10% of the market as well. So interesting that this came back so strong. 70% of teens use Spotify, up from 68% just 6 months ago. 46% of these teens actually subscribe and pay for it as well, which is up from 44%. In terms of favourite social platform, Steve, it was TikTok at 38%, Snap was second with 28%, and Instagram was third with 23%. And last couple of bits for you here. Teens spend 28.7% of daily video consumption watching Netflix, which is down a little bit, 29.1% watching YouTube, which is up a little bit, and 87% of teens surveyed owned an iPhone, and 88% expect an iPhone to be their next phone, but only 34% of them own an Apple Watch at the moment. So tons of information there. Appreciate people might have to go through that a few times, but that was what I pulled out of the survey. I think it's really interesting, and because we're all old and don't know what kids want nowadays, and then
really interesting.
It's an interesting little thing.
Yeah, a few bits of there kind of stood out to me. One that you said towards the end, actually, which was favorite social media platforms. TikTok is not a massive surprise to me. I would have said TikTok or Instagram. I'm surprised at seeing Snap second. I thought Snap was basically garbage, or basically dead, or basically waiting to be acquired by something. But it's popular with teens, huh?
5% stronger than Instagram, so it's quite considerably more popular with teens.
So the and that's kind of interesting because when we Snap think of what the future is going to be, it's what the teens are at now, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so the difference with Snap, it seems, is you could make it into a sort of little dating app as well, because it's geotagged and geolocated, so you can literally go on a map and see what videos people are posting in your vicinity right around you. Instagram hasn't quite got there yet, but it has got a similar tool which can do that. I'm not sure about TikTok because I really use that the least, if I'm honest. Interesting, Mondelez Cliff Bars were number one snack for teens in the US. Did I hear that right?
I don't know what they are.
They're like these little... I'm pretty sure if I... Just Google it quickly. I'm pretty sure
you are the best traveled of us.
Yeah, they are. They're branded to climbers, as in, like, it's like you would have seen them if you live. I mean, he lives in the north, for God's sake. You would have seen them. They're like these little brown packets with a little climber on. I'm pretty sure that's what they are. The Mondelez cliff bars.
Yeah, I'm just looking.
They're
at
like
now.
High,
yeah,
energy.
I've never seen them before in my life. Yeah, they're little energy like flapjack bars.
Oh,
yeah, that sort of thing. And that's really, really surprises me. That's quite interesting. So this sort of thing, then, do we think that teenagers grow up and move on to different things, or these are the things that grow up with teenagers? What do we think?
I think in the main, these are things that grow up with teenagers. There are a few kind of exceptions, maybe. I think teenagers spend more time in places like Chick-fil-A, McDonald's, and whatever you said the other one was. Subway was the other one you mentioned, I think. I think they spend more time in these places than older adults do once they hit sort of 30 or whatever it is. I think I was talking to some of my friends the other day who say they genuinely can't remember the last time they were in a McDonald's. And this is not kind of with their kids or whatever. I can remember last time I was in McDonald's. I was in there the other week. I still like them. But it seems like people really kind of go off that. Teens like it because it's cheap, I think, and fairly unfussy, and they're fine there. But maybe it's the part of the world that I live in, and at least people have pretensions on being kind of higher minded than McDonald's. But I feel like McDonald's is constantly the place for people who are teens, but not necessarily people who move on from being teens and so on. So there'll be another cohort of teens coming in to take their place. I mean, fewer in the US because birth rate's quite low there. But it feels to me like that they aim at that kind of level and they stay at that level. They're a bit like kids' TV shows, right? They don't stay with you as you grow up, but your kids might come in and watch them after you, I think, anyway. Steve?
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is... it's the brand's job to keep these people spending there as they grow through life, so that, you know, they can't just appeal to, you know, just to teens. They've got to have an adult range as well. So if you know, I don't see many brands here that are just, you know, aimed at kids only. So you know, it's their responsibility to keep some kind of loyalty program that keeps these people returning throughout the whole life. Otherwise, it's a fad and not a trend, isn't it? And you want these companies to be instigating new trends rather than fads, I think is generally the case.
I was wondering where Vivo Barefoot came in the trainers one. I'm going to have to go back and have a look at that, because that seems very, very popular with at least early 20s at the moment, as they go through these. Again, they're following the quotes on Instagram, David Goggins and all that stuff. And they seem to be buying into these sorts of, I don't know if the fads, they may be legit, I'm not sure. But you mentioned Hoka, and that's obviously, and On One as well. They seem to be older brands that older people have sort of started to pick up. I wonder if that's gonna be a trend as well. It looks like buying Mondelez. maybe that's what it is. Yeah, Mondelez, Nike. What else was in there that investing for 30
ELF
years?
ELF Beauty or ELF, something.
Yeah,
Monster. Monster's Becky still ETF. Been very popular.
Yeah, Monster. That's going to be there for a while. I've noticed a lot of other companies move into the energy drinks market. Have you? I noticed Rio Energy the other day, and I thought, okay, this is getting out of hand now.
Coke are in there as well with various things. They're trying to move bottled water. And when you think about Coke and you think about the question of growth, it's very natural to wonder, well, exactly how many more lots of Coke can you get into the hands of Americans, basically? And the growth isn't really supposed to be that. It's supposed to be things like energy drinks, like bottled water, and it's mostly supposed to be kind of emerging market-based. I think probably the one of these that I think, to your initial question, Paul, I think is likely to kind of grow with the teens. I mean, famously, Apple's iPhone is supposed to be quite a sticky thing to get rid of. And Steve said, I think something like 80% of them think their next phone is going to be an iPhone. I mean, maybe some of them are wrong about that.
88.
And maybe some of them are wrong the other way. 88%, right? So that's, if you assume that nearly all teens have a phone and therefore will replace at some point, I think that's probably quite likely. That might be close to like 88% of teens, basically, then in that case, that think their next phone is going to be an iPhone. And that's the one more than the rest of these that appears to, well, it very definitely has at least some switching costs associated with it. Exactly how high you think they are is kind of questionable, but it's far easier to switch away from McDonald's or Clif Bars than it is from an iPhone in this way. So that's the one where I think I own shares in Apple. That kind of encourages me a bit, right? If you want to try and hook people into an ecosystem, and you think 88% of them, once they reach teen and upwards, are likely to be in there already, and then either trying to get out or unable to get out or whatever, then that's the one that I think is probably I'm most encouraged by in terms of long-term trend stuff.
The one that shocked me the most, I think, was the video games being such a low amount of wallet share, only coming in at 11% and falling from 12% only in the fall when we looked at it. In spring when we looked at it last time. So that's quite interesting to me. I would have thought that would have been higher, because that's 11% of male teen wallet share as well, which you would say video games, are they skewed towards males? Maybe that's not true, but it is quite a low amount of wallet share in comparison to the other things.
Is it because their parents are buying everything for them?
Potentially.
It's very possible that, you know, because they're such big purchases, games are very big purchases, the consoles themselves are very big purchases, they might not actually be coming out of the teen's wallet, and that might be something involved. To go back to Apple, as somebody who has done the transition from Apple to Android, I can assure you that it was extremely sticky and extremely hard to get off. They make it stupid hard for you to get off. And not to mention, once you have got off, the social ousting that you get from that is really, really tough. In fact, WhatsApp and Facebook are probably the only two things that have saved my social life, as far as that goes, which could be a really strange instance, because you go from the blue the blue bubble to the green bubble, and all of a sudden that's it. People, you're not placed as high of a priority on people's phones as you were when you were an Apple customer. It's quite interesting, although that could just be my excuse for no one liking me.
That is,
or responding to your messages. Yeah,
fascinating to me.
All right, let's move on. We've covered that a lot.
Okay, in that case, let's talk about some earnings. Let's start ourselves off with one then that I was supposed to be talking about last week, but we ran out of time. And Paul is right, if we don't get on with this, it will happen again. So, Croda International, a UK stock, which means, of course, they have a base in what city, Paul? See, if you watch the show more often, you will know that every...
Omaha?
You will know that every UK-based company is, of course, headquartered within a two-mile radius of Steve's house.
Croda House,
International. In Hull. There we go. So Hull-based Croda International. Next to Hull-based B&M Bargains, just around the corner from Hull-based Halma, and just across the street from Hull-based Diploma. And Hull-based Daifuku and Sweden Handelsbanker. Yeah, that thing too.
Wait, are they still using the ports in Hull? Is that what it is? They're still shipping ports in Hull?
No, I only found out the other day that they've actually sold the £700 million facility to Cargill's in Hull. So it was a sizable outfit. But yeah, Croda aren't actually in Hull anymore.
Yeah,
so
Croda are not in Hull anymore. And related to that point, cause and effect and so on, right? Their stock is down 38% over the last 12 months, which makes it the worst performing FTSE 100 stock. You move out of Hull Commercial Centre at your peril. The reason I was talking about this, or getting ready to talk about this last week, is because the thing had fallen another 7% after their latest trading update, i.e. earnings report with no numbers in it. So the kind of headline news here is they're expecting profits for the year to be 20% lower than their expectations, which is not good because their expectations were already significantly lower than the year before. They're now looking for between 300 and 320 million versus what was going to be 370 to 400 million for the year. They have a 5.7 billion market cap, by the way, just for context. And for context, that is now they have a 5.7 billion market cap at the time we're recording this, which is Saturday the 21st. It was obviously a lot higher 12 months ago. It was 38% that's come off it. So they have a 44 quid share price. They're looking for earnings per share of $2. $2, crikey. Oh, shoot me. £2.14 to £2.29. And that's compared to £4.65 in 2022. Before that, they were looking at, before the kind of COVID-y stuff, they were £1.70 to £1.80 sort of region. what's going on here then? So this is a chemicals company. They sell chemicals, specialty chemicals, so not commodity chemicals, into end markets. They are things like consumer care, so they're busy whacking stuff into ELF or ELF beauty products, maybe. Crop protection, pharma, and industrial stuff. And their big growth arm as they see it, which is the only one that's showing any kind of resilience anyway, is pharma. Their lipids business sells into mRNA vaccines. And if you think mRNA vaccines are the future, which a lot of people do, and Croda, I suppose, are hoping they are, this could be pretty good. Everything else, though, is selling off, and demand is way, 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 way down. The reason being, inventory levels are far too high. Inventory levels got built during the pandemic, and they are currently still at fairly elevated levels. And Croda has been wrong for about the last 6 to 12 maybe months about how quickly that inventory is going to work its way off. So their trading updates, this is why that stock has been falling for the last year, have been along the lines of inventory level at end users is still way too high, therefore demand is still way down, therefore we're still not selling anything, therefore it's really hard to kind of make any money. Someone asked me in the Discord whether this big 38% sell-off thing is a buying opportunity here, and I can see the case for thinking it is. You would expect that. The stock obviously went on a massive run during the COVID thing while people thought £4.65 is the earnings forever, and if you think £4.65 is the earnings forever, then a 44 quid share price, which is sort of where we are, we're now at 40 quid share price actually, but even 44 quid share price is pretty cheap. Obviously, that was not the case. That's how it was going to work out forever. But people sort of, the stock went on a massive run like it does. Since then, it's been coming down and down and down and down. If you think, by the way, you've heard this story before, it's the same story kind of as Synthoma, which is my pick for JKR investing, and I'm still losing on that. The main difference between Croda and Synthoma, as far as I can tell, is there's a difference at the product level, but at the investor kind of level, the main difference is that Croda's balance sheet is not a mess, and Synthoma's is. Croda doesn't have creditors banging on its doors anytime soon. I think they can ride out a kind of cyclical downturn. It's not good for them. They will want to cut costs, and lower sales are not helpful, and they can do with end markets recovering sooner rather than later. But I don't think they're a kind of big bankruptcy risk in the way that Synthoma might be if things don't kind of shape themselves up and they sell off units at a decent price in the way that they're currently doing. So is there a question of buying the low here? Well, it's at a 5-year low. It's not. It's like below pre-COVID levels here. You have to think this business is in worse shape, or the environment is somehow worse than it was when it started. Arguably, it is. Interest rates are higher than they were back then, so you shouldn't be pricing it the same. But its earnings are coming in at, let's say, 214 to 229 in a bad year, is still sort of 10, 20% higher than they were pre-COVID. I can see why this might be attractive here. Steve, has this now moved out of your circle of competence as a result of having moved out of your postcode?
Funny you ask, because I'm just looking where Croda is now headquarters.
Doug's office in Oxford, is it?
No, it's about 20 miles away, just outside of a place called Goole.
Which
is evidently why the share price is falling. But yeah, they have a look at headquarters if you get a second, people. It's like a massive stately home. I was not expecting that to be the office, but... I didn't know Croda did as many things as they actually do here, because I seem to remember, in my head I just thought it was a paint factory, and I thought that was basically what they did, was paints. But no, they're involved in a hell of a lot of things. Interested in the being part of the lipid systems, interested in the life sciences, in the industrial specialties division as well. There's a lot of interesting bits in here which are just going through sort of cyclically weak demand. And yet they're still expecting profit before tax to be, you know, in the 300 to 320 million range. Looking at the market cap quickly, you're at what, 5.71 billion at the moment, it says. Mm-hmm. On Google. So it's not cheap. It's not really, really cheap. It's not UK market cheap, but this is a premium business with potentially some growth prospects.
Yeah, when I tried to work out what that meant for EPS, I got sort of 214 to 229, 40 share price, 17 times earnings. That's higher than the average for the FTSE 100. So you need to be thinking it's going to grow faster than the average for the index. It might. There's definitely worse businesses in that big index, and it might well
be traded at much higher than that, though, nearly double that kind of range. It's been in the 30s to 36.
Yeah, when I first looked at this ages ago, it was in the sort of 30s, and I thought it looks really good, but I couldn't bring myself to buy it at 30. Not for a particularly good reason. I hadn't got any ideas about inventory levels coming through and COVID push and that sort of thing. Just thought. I kind of thought this looks really good, and I still kind of think it looks good. I think the issue for them and the issue for investors, and this is true in so many different areas that we'll come back to in as we look through other companies as well, they are trying to work out what supply and demand looks like in normal circumstances for them, right? Because they've gone through a period of artificially high demand, and now they're going through a period of artificially low demand because inventory levels won't be too high forever. There won't be a COVID pandemic forever. So it's not that, and it's not this. And the question is, where does that kind of fit in the middle of this? And that's the kind of hard bit, right, to try and predict if you're an investor. And that's the real sort of challenge here. I wonder whether you might think that they're, the 17 earnings, I move in circles a little bit here, right? I think earnings per share, okay, this is a bad year and it's going to be higher than 2018, 2019, 2017, all that sort of thing. So it's growing, if that's what you consider a bad year. And if you think things will get better before they get kind of eventually anyway, then it looks okay. But we're still looking at 17 times earnings. UK stock, could you find cheaper? I mean, yeah, you certainly could.
What's its lowest? What's its mean average? You know, because obviously we know there's different types of stocks out there. You've got your growth stocks in the, you know, mega cap tech. They trade at 30 times earnings, and we sort of see 22 times earnings as quite reasonable, you know, a reasonable time to buy sometimes. No one expects the likes of Apple and Google. I'm not saying it won't. I'm just saying that no one expects it to go down to 15 times earnings anymore. And then you've got the whole mess of stocks in the middle, which seem to run at that whole average of 15 to 16 times earnings. And then you've got that side lot of defensive type stocks that tend to trade high. Costco, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, those sorts of stocks that tend to trade quite high on earnings in general. So when they make that little drop down to 17 times earnings, is that like a relative low for some of these stocks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, in the case of Croda, they got up to really quite high levels. I'm looking, they were at around... Oh, what am I reading there? 101, quid, yeah, 101, 104 quid a share while they were busy making four in sort of earnings. So about 25, they might have got close to 30 times earnings if you think from the year before of 2021. So 30 is the high end. I think 17 might be towards the lower end, to be honest. And then you kind of mean somewhere in the middle. But I don't think they spend much time in their kind of mean reversion average thing. I don't think they tend to be at 20. They tend to be kind of either side of that, and you get an average by taking the high point and the low point here, even if it never really gets to there very often. Steve?
Been an incredible investment, this, though, Steve. If you bought this one at IPO, it was nearly a 50x at its peak, and it's still, an 18x today, despite falling 60% from its peak. So that's quite an impressive return, that, isn't it, for what I thought was just a paint company.
Yeah, I IPO'd around the time I did, by the way, as well, by the look of it. July 1988, July. I was a month later. So my thought on this is that I don't see this as a kind of screaming obvious buy right at the moment. I think if you like buying good companies, it's well worth a look. If it keeps falling, and it is keep falling, by the way, at the moment, this could get really interesting and you could get a nice opportunity here, because there clearly are... not artificial, they really exist, but cyclical headwinds for this, which I think are going to kind of fall off. And I do think Croda will be okay. So the risk with cyclical thing, or the big risk with cyclical pressures, is that they could kill you, basically. If you don't make any money for long enough, eventually you go out of business. But I don't see that happening in the case of Croda. Sorry, Steve.
Just going to say quickly, before we do shuffle on, there's a business breakdowns this week on Olin, which is a chemicals company.
There was one on either Dow or DuPont the other week as well.
Very, very interesting, the one on Olin, because it's a company that's trying to smooth out their cyclicality in terms of demand. So it'd be a really interesting one for people to do a comparison on. But I appreciate we've got 15 minutes, which is 7.5 minutes on ASML and 7.5 on Tesla. So shall I quickly rattle through ASML?
No, take your time on ASML. We'll just fit everything on Tesla into the last 10 seconds and put it out as a short.
Okay,
it'd be
fair
pretty
enough.
Easy, right?
So ASML, this was a decent report. I think this is what we've probably come to expect from ASML. So system sales came in at about 5.3 billion euros on the quarter. There was growth in all of their areas except EUV and metrology, which had double-digit falls. Now, as you know, with systems at this size and price, that literally means just a handful of systems didn't ship in time. If you add in install base management, which is what you would call servicing, I guess, to system sales, you get about 6.7 billion in euros. That was growth of about 15%. Cost of sales came in at 3.2 billion, leaving gross profit of about 3.5 billion. That was flat year on year. Op profit came in at 32% margin, which was down 1 percentage point. Net profit, 1.9 billion, which was 28% margin, also down 1 percentage point. So financially, loads to love there. Looking at logic and memory sales, this year has clearly been about fulfilling logic demand. They've already fulfilled 2.5 billion more in logic orders than all of last financial years, with a quarter still to go. Quarterly net bookings were 2.6 billion, of which 0.5 billion are for EUVs, finishing a short two quarters of sequential acceleration. Q1 net bookings were 3.75, Q2 4.5 billion. This is actually the highest drop in ASML's backlog that we've had during 2023. This is giving signs of sort of like uncertain short-term outlook from some semiconductor companies. But China, South Korea, and Taiwan made up over 75% of all orders shipped for the second month running. USA slipped from 10% or from orders last quarter to just 5% this time. In terms of capital return, 100 million of buybacks in the last quarter, dividend of €1.45. The next dividend will be the same amount again. In terms of outlook, ASML, we're looking at about 6.9 billion at the midpoint next quarter, gross margin between 50 and 51%, R&D and SG&A to come in just a touch over 1.3 billion. Reaffirmed the previous guidance of about 30% growth, slight gross margin improvement. So all good as far as I was concerned. So I listened to the call with respect to bookings. Peter Wenning said there was some weakness was expected, more so given how the backlog has built up in the last couple of years. However, given his view on how strong of a year 2025 would be, he thinks bookings will start to recover and he'll start giving those signs around towards the end of 2024 and perhaps by the first half, he said. And then CFO Dasan said there's some really good quality fabs coming on in the next online in the next couple of years. They'll need the tools. Demand is strong. There were lots of questions on the call about China. ASML said actually it's a minimal impact to sales as the vast majority of products sold are mature nodes. They're not covered by the ban. It's actually only a handful of fabs in China that are affected by the ban. So with all this in mind, what did they predict that they will grow revenue in 2024? Was it 10? Was it 20? Or was it 30%? Not even close. It was zero. ASML is predicting that they'll be flat next year. And that sent the market into a little bit of a panic, and ASML fell quite a bit the next day. However, got to bear in mind, Peter said, looking ahead to 2025, we expect significant growth here, since more than 50% of our EUV and DUV shipments will go to brand new fab projects. So what are we doing here with ASML? I think at the moment, absolutely nothing. I think there's no need to panic. I think we're expecting a fairly flat year next year, so I wouldn't expect massive appreciation in stock price unless ASML gets some hype out about what's coming in 2025. But yeah, I thought this was a very fine report and nothing really too exciting in it at all for me.
Wonderful confirmation bias there for me, to be honest with you. I don't think you've said anything I didn't already hope that you were going to say. The 0% growth next year was quite, you know, you looked at it and I kind of went, it doesn't really make it makes sense. There's lots of places not ordering at the moment. There's a lot of uncertainty. Nobody wants to get in out over the skis at the moment, and so everyone's just taking a bit of a chill. But my thoughts were that the Arizona fab companies are going to open in the next couple of years. That's going to start a ton of orders for ASML. They're only going to go to ASML. In fact, we'll talk about that in a second as well. I'm sure you'll want to mention the Japanese getting in on EUV at the moment. But the it seems like the US share, which I think was 5%, did you say? It's only 5% this year. The US share of their revenue is probably going to go up significantly in 2025, and that's what we're looking forward to. I bought, probably not on their full drop, but I bought probably £300-400 worth just to keep my averaging up on that. Very happy. I can't see a reason. The only other reason why the drop, so there's a couple of reasons why the drop may have been extended. Of course, ASML could well be overbought. It could well be overvalued, as it were. I don't think it is in the long run. The long run of the 30 years, it was around 55 times earnings, wasn't it? It's probably a bit lower than that. Probably more like 40 times earnings at the moment now. But also, Canon appear to be bringing on, they reckon they've made a different type of breakthrough in EUV, and I think that spooked the market. It all came at once. Canon seemed to release their news about this a few days before ASML's earnings release, and it doesn't appear like it's too much of a threat at this time. In fact, it all seemed theoretical in my brain. A lot of people saying that this is where China's now going to get their EUV technology from the future, and I can't see that happening. Do you have any thoughts on that, or have I kind of just brought that out to you a bit unexpected?
No. So I read about nano imprinting, which is Canon's way of challenging the EUV machine that ASML is putting out. It looks like interesting technology, but I don't think your likes of TSMC, Samsung, which are, and in Intel, I suppose now we can say, which are experts in using these machines, are going to quickly jump over to Canon unless there's a serious price difference between the model, which hasn't been released yet. So you're looking at about between $200 and $500 million for an ASML machine. And that is just because of the sheer amount of parts and bits that go into it. That, you know, genuinely costs that much to set up, install, deliver. There's something the size of a double decker bus. So unless Canon comes out with some pricing which is, you know, incredibly under ASML, I don't see the jump away, because it's a whole new system for these companies to learn. Especially from a company that up until this point has basically focused on making, you know, lower quality, older, sort of less intelligent chips. So it's an interesting one. It's probably one of those that, if Canon comes out with a good price of this, might be worth holding a basket of both. But otherwise, I think it's a wait and see at the moment.
Yeah, it's the timeline. You've got probably 30 years of testing, and in that time, ASML are hoping to be on the next stage. And so I think there's, I'm not totally worried, but I do think it spooked the market, which may have led to a buying opportunity. I'm not saying it's a buying opportunity. I was just buying it. You guys need to go off and figure that out for yourself. Any other?
You should think it's a buying opportunity, Paul. This PE number I've got written down is much lower than the one you had. You've got it at 40 or so, and correct. I think if it was at 40, it would have taken more of a whack than it did. I've got this at a PE ratio of about 29, 28 at the moment.
Oh, really?
Looking at backward earnings.
Oh, there we go, then.
And that sort of speaks to my thought on this one, which is that Steve and I, or Steve sent me very briefly, or we were looking at a different company, which is Intuitive Surgical, which nearly everyone sort of knows about. It's not a million miles in terms of style of business from ASML. They make highly advanced surgical robots, but they came in with some light earnings, I think, and their stock took a whack this week. And my reaction to that was, my reaction I've always had when I thought about Intuitive Surgical, if I don't understand why this thing is so expensive. I get that there's a price for predictability, and that much is pretty good in the case of Intuitive Surgical, but the thing's been growing its earnings, whether you look at them at op income level or earnings per share level, about 7% for the last decade. Trades at a price earnings ratio of about 70, and I think that's a lot to pay for something that's growing like that. And people go on about how good of a business it is. Brian Feroldi talks about it a lot. He's not wrong, but it doesn't seem to make the kind of money that I think it needs to make at the market cap it has, and it does this repeatedly. And eventually, the market kind of went whack, and it still trades at about 70 times earnings ratio, by the way. But when you're up there on big numbers, any kind of bad news or slowing growth or whatever, like, say, forecasting static top line for the next year in the case of ASML, doesn't play very well, and I think that's kind of reasonable here. This looks to me like I think of this like I think of Crota, to be honest with you. Okay, there's a bit of a cyclical downturn in kind of people not wanting to get out over their skis, as you put it. So future orders are down from where they were before. That'll turn itself around. The question is when, and the market will treat this justifiably as something that didn't have the outlook that it they thought it did. The time you want to buy it is when they think it doesn't have as positive an outlook as opposed to when they do. And that might be now. And that might be the case that, again, to your thought about kind of average PEs, Paul, 20-something is relatively low in the range that this kind of stuff trades in. Maybe this is your opportunity.
It's strange, isn't it? Because I think people have reacted to this in a really strange scenario. So say, for instance, you know the PlayStation 5 was coming out. The day before, you wouldn't rush out to go buy the PlayStation 4, you know, full market rate. And that's kind of how it is with ASML at the moment. They've got a brand new machine on the horizon, and people are wondering why the backlog's dropping slightly and why they're expecting a flat year. And I think it is as simple as that analogy. I think people are just waiting for the brand new machine. It would seem pointless to have the other one at the moment. Just having a really quick look at Nano Imprint, there's a number of issues with it at the moment in that the yield on really high-end chips is quite bad. And the reason why you buy these cutting-edge machines from ASML is that the yield on high-end chips is quite good, and ASML quite regularly improve it. So I think there's plenty of work here for Canon to do. I think I don't think we're... immediately going to get out positioned here.
All right. Speaking of stocks dropping based on weak earnings and overbought stocks, Tesla is down 15% on this week because of a rather poor earnings report. Well, we can discuss whether it was a poor earnings report. Tesla. Let me just get my numbers up. There we go. Tesla reported $23.35 billion in revenue. That's up 13% year on year, but only reported $1.85 billion in profits. That is putting them on course to have their second earnings decline year in a row. That's quite an interesting point. Still really low R&D spend. Orders not getting through very well. I think there was less deliveries. I'm not going to go over the numbers too much because I think they're already out there. But in general, what we were waiting for was the earnings call. We were going to, I think probably like you guys, I'm not really interested in Tesla anymore. There was a point in a couple of years ago where we were all interested in seeing what Tesla was doing to grow. And now I don't really look. When these earnings came out, all I wanted to see was the earnings call and how Elon Musk was going to wiggle his way out of this one. And personally, he did pretty terribly. I don't know if you guys have actually seen it, but he was talking about the Cybertruck, how it's not going to be delivered on time. It's not going to be cash flow positive for a good few years. One of the key points I saw were he believes he has over 1 million people who have reserved the car, and that means there's a huge there's no demand issue whatsoever. But we have to remember that these reserves were $100 and fully refundable if you didn't want the car anymore. So I just don't see that as a metric that you can trust. In the earnings call, when I listened to this, I felt like he was very, very much just changing the subject all the time. Whenever there was a question about profitability, about R&D spend, or, you know, whether AI was going to work out, he would always change it to someone else. I think at one point he even just went on a rant about working from home, and he was saying how people who are working from home are still morally incorrect because everybody else doesn't have the same opportunities that they do, coming from the richest man in the world who has a lot of opportunities and doesn't share that out at all. It was a really odd earnings call. A lot of squirming around, a lot of trying to justify things. It's like he's been caught red-handed. What are we starting to see here with Tesla? How do you feel?
My thoughts on Tesla were sort of twofold. There's, as there always is with earnings calls, there's the backward-looking bit where they tell you what they did over the last 3 months, and there's the forward-looking bit where they tell you what they're going to do the next 3 months and kind of beyond in some cases. And the stock went down, and we were chatting to someone on the Trading 212 forum who actually made a lot better sense of this than I did. I've now forgotten his name in Steve's thread on the subject, but was asking why there wasn't a bigger decline when Tesla read their kind of backwards looking numbers out, and then said, oh, hang on, no, there it is, it's after the guidance bit, which I thought was pretty sharp. That makes a lot of sense to me. So, okay, the numbers were what they were. You might think on the face of it they don't look terribly impressive, but I don't think anyone should have been massively surprised by this. Tesla has been discounting over the last quarter, so margins come down when you discount things. That's kind of how that works and how that happens, and that's just what discounting does from what I can see of it. It's also known that they've had operational issues, I think, out of Shanghai. It was a shutdown on their factory there, so fewer cars came out of it. Sure, that was also known about and shouldn't have been surprising anybody to learn that there were fewer cars and they sold at a lower price. I mean, who didn't know that going into it? The looking forward bit was a bit more of a kind of concern to me. I mean, it was... Musk made the point about the Cybertruck stuff. I didn't know much what to make of that, but he wanted to talk about a kind of cyclical slowdown and a tough macro economy. And I think he's probably right about that. It will be difficult to sell things into a tough macro economy. But Tesla is priced to grow. It's not priced to get held up by a slow macro economy. When I look at it and I try to do some numbers on it compared to other things that are available, I think they're pricing about 25% growth each year for the next decade to get to level with other things that you can buy right now. We can argue backwards and forwards about whether or not that's likely to happen, but every year they go backwards, that number becomes bigger of what's priced in going forwards, assuming the stock doesn't go anywhere here and assuming its competitors do what I think they're going to do, which is not grow at that rate. So an example I've been comparing it to recently was Shell. I think Shell's average income is going to be about 5% higher over the next decade than the last, because I think oil prices are going to be slightly higher. Based on the price it sells at and the way it generates cash, and the same goes for Tesla, Tesla's going to grow at 25% to match them. Okay, maybe that's going to happen, maybe it isn't. But talking about a cyclical slowdown there means that we're going to get behind, and it means that we have work to do to try and catch up here. Maybe the longer term outlook is better. There's loads going on. There's self-driving stuff. There's battery storage. There's supercomputing. There's humanoid robots. There's everything you can name. There's Cybertrucks that are going to be there, but they're going to be another year away until they start really making a difference to the bottom line here, which I think is also, I don't view that positively. Make of it what you will. I mean, I think Tesla's kind of bulls here are going to tell me that's not disastrous. They may well be right about that, but I don't think it's good. So I didn't think this was a terrific report. I don't think I'm going to change anybody's mind about anything on that score, though. Steve?
At the risk of upsetting people here,
oh, good. Here
I
we
thought
go.
This was probably one of the worst reports we've had so far. The Cybertruck makes me laugh because it looks like something somebody would make in the garage with a hammer and some sheet metal.
The finished product is so much worse than what they've been showing, isn't it?
It's a thoroughly unimpressive looking car. It is one of the most awful looking things I've ever seen in my life.
Just because they don't manufacture this thing in whole that you're cross about it?
Bastards. But no, I had a few, because I posted up these earnings on the Trading 212 community, and I thought these were massively unimpressive. So many people saying you can't think of Tesla as a car company, it's a tech company. Well, like 80% of its revenue still is derived from cars, so how am I supposed to look at it? I think all the other things are just like hopium. Sort of Elon.
Battery's getting better, right? Solar and battery's getting a bit better.
Well, this is the thing, though. Solar grew, batteries grew, the margin on those improved, yet the operating margins on Tesla now have fallen that far that they're the same as Volkswagen. The operating margins on Tesla are the same as Volkswagen, and Volkswagen isn't the best car manufacturer. That means it's worse than Mercedes-Benz, it's worse than BMW, it's worse than Stellantis. So I'm sat there having a bunch of people like saying to me, it's a tech company. You've got to think of it like a tech company, where its margins have fallen so far from tech, they've fallen to car manufacturer. and then people saying, well, you know, you've got to value it like a tech company. Well, it is valued like a tech company, because if you add up all of the car manufacturers in the in the world, you get to the valuation of Tesla. It trades at, what, 80 times earnings before this report. I don't know what it is now. It's 9 times sales premium to Toyota, the next most highly valued
100 times
car,
free cash flow, by
company,
the way.
Because Tesla is a car company. Free cash flow was a joke. There was 808 million, but 500 of that was from regulatory credits. So you sub them off because eventually someone's got to get wise to the fact that they're just getting a cash handout every quarter. So if we're saying 303 million of cash flow on, what, an 808 billion market cap company, you're talking about what, annualize that at 1.2 billion. What's that, 65 years to get your money back in terms of cash flow? That's just a joke. I just honestly, yeah, if this company falls in half, it'd be like, oh, shocked face. Do you know what I mean? It's completely a zero interest rate, overvalued company. And I don't even have a dog in the fight. I don't even have a short position against it. Don't short anything. I just think it's just a zero interest rate story. That's unraveling the way zero interest rate stories unravel.
That was his big defense. Really, was high interest rates, wasn't it? It was, but it wasn't any. The interest rates weren't affecting anything to do with Tesla. It was all the customer. The customer couldn't afford their cars. We need to make our cars cheaper. Blah blah blah. It wasn't. We've took because they haven't taken out a lot of debt. You know, they're not particularly indebted, but their suppliers are, and there's a lot of problems there. They've had to raise prices, so they're missing out on half the story. At least that's what it seemed to be in the earnings call. And one of their products now has gone terribly wrong, and he's half admitted it. I expect probably in the next year, the full admission will probably come out about the Cybertruck. And the go on.
Did you see the absolute chart crime that they put on the presentation where they had?
I didn't watch it.
Price to produce a Tesla Model 3, I think it was. And in the top was a line going from the very, very top of the chart all the way to the very, very bottom. It was like, look at this huge, steep decline. The difference was $650. You're like,
yeah, I've
seen
it.
They've gone from like it's, 37 to 36,350 or something like that. You're like, that is an absolute chart crime. Do you know what I mean? It was just ridiculous.
Yeah, Tesla do that all the time, though. They've done it with battery improvement. They did it from, they show, again, the same thing. Big line from the top, big line to the bottom, and the difference was like 3 years. And it was like, hold on, guys, you've made the chart really small there. Let's stretch this out and see exactly how far the line goes. So yeah, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors with Tesla. I think that's one of the problems why I can't really get my head around it. You have to really believe in it to want to buy into this thing. I didn't want to be too harsh, but I think it's going that way, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. We're going to get some cross people in the comments, and maybe justifiably, right? I mean, none of us is that impressed by it, but smarter people than us are in some cases. Elon is very good. You're not going to get the full admission the Cybertruck's gone wrong. You're going to get something that says it's time to focus on the humanoid robot or something like that, by the way, which you'll have to decode into saying the Cybertruck hasn't been the success that we'd hoped. When I think about Tesla, I come down to one thought here, which is that this price is much too high at the moment. It's hoping for a lot, and I'm not sure I see hoping for a lot. I do like a lot of what they have, though. The US charging stuff, that to me looks like big money business. The trouble is, you have to pay even bigger money business for it to be worth it. So if the thing got cut in half, I might start trying to work out how much I think a standard US charging thing could be worth to Tesla, even if you ignore the cars it's making and all the rest of that stuff. You're right about the debt thing, by the way, Paul. Company like Tesla absolutely shouldn't have any debt. If your stock's traded that high for the last however long, you shouldn't be borrowing money to go and fund stuff. You should be doing it by printing as many shares as you need, which I think is what they've done, and randomly splitting your stock to make it go even higher, which is also what they've done. I was going to bring it onto that because
you mentioned there the Tesla network charger has to it has to be rolled out, doesn't it? Which is going to cost a lot in development. It's going to cost a lot in just simple capex. So how do they get that money? They still have the option of taking out debt, but I probably wouldn't advise that in this environment. Although technically 5% interest rates is normal. That's what we're being told now. but they can still print. You know, there's still a huge market cap on there. They could still print a lot more shares and still gain a hell of a lot more money out of that.
That sounds like the kind of thing that there ought to be some sort of government-assisted funding thing for, right? Building out a massive EV charging power station thing. I mean, what else is the US investing in if it's not the most promising bit of, like, green tech stuff that I can think of right now? You know, EV infrastructure, basically.
War, I think, is taking a bit of a precedent at the minute. So, yay.
Okay.
Right, I think we can wrap it up there, can't we?
Yeah, I think that'll probably do. A comment down below. What did you think of our horrendously misguided thoughts on Tesla? What is it we're all missing? And ideally, try and help us see what we're missing in a way that isn't just pointing at bits of the business and saying, but it's got this and got this. Because yeah. I know I'd be
the
really interested in working
Kool-Aid.
Out... I'd be interested in working out how it is all these bits of business add up to the market cap for where we're at the moment. That's the bit that I really struggle to see. But let us know down below. Steve, sorry, go on.
Sorry, my favourite thing to ask Tesla people
Kathy?
Is, could you do that for me with the maths? And then all of a sudden they go, no. Because
oh my God.
It's like they work out all the maths and then they need to work out a 600 billion hole.
Yeah, Cathy Wood's probably the best one at that, right? She's been quiet for a while now.
They get to a 600 billion hole and they
still
go, oh, but Jetsons robots and cars built out of sheet metal and the paint's going to be better.
Humanoids.
SpaceX.
We're hoping to end this in the next 2 hours, so let's stop talking about Tesla for a bit, shall we? Right, thank you all very much for listening. We'll see you next week on the Playing Footsie Show. Bye for now.